Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. The Let's Get Busy podcast is supported by listeners like you. Help support the show by logging on to lgbpodcast.blogspot.com and clicking donate. Welcome to Let's Get Busy, a weekly podcast where I talk shop and get down to business with authors, illustrators, award winners, up-and-comers, and everyone in between. I'm Matthew Winner, an elementary school librarian, author of the Busy Librarian blog, and your host. This is episode number 172 with Adam Rex, author and illustrator of a ton of amazing books, including The True Meaning of Smeck Day, which was adapted into an animated feature film called Home, and the book's sequel, Smeck for President, which is published by Disney Hyperion. I'm a big fan of Adam's and his Smeck smearies. I had to say it. It's just so good. So during our chat, I sort of just let the conversation go where it wanted, and I just enjoyed the ride. I hope you do as well. Here's episode number 172 of the podcast with Adam Rex. Let's get busy. Welcome to the Let's Get Busy podcast, Adam Rex. I'm excited to talk to you today.
I'm excited too. Thank you for having me on, Matthew.
Adam, you have come up, I mean, probably because of some of the other people I've talked to as well, but you've just sort of come up over and over and over in these podcast conversations. You've worked with some really great talents in KidLit, and you create outstanding books that, as a librarian, we all talk and talk about, probably because they work so well, not only to read to kids, but also for us as adults to enjoy. So thank you off the bat for just writing the way you do and being such a great talent and such a great asset to children's publishing.
That's really gratifying to hear. Thanks.
Yeah, I love, you know, very recently we were, I was talking to my friend Julie Falatko, and we were doing this quarterly podcast that I do to talk about the best books that have come out so far. And she right away mentioned Smeck for President. And then after that, I had the chance to read it as well and loved it. And I just think, again, I love that not only did I first know you or primarily know you for illustration, but that you got such a great handle on storytelling that it lends itself so well to writing middle grade and YA too. It's awesome.
Yeah, I'm sort of surprised that there aren't, I mean, there are a lot of us, obviously, that that both write and illustrate. But I think for the most part, the illustrators who do write, you tend to find them sticking primarily to picture books. And I'm a little surprised that there aren't more of us that write novels as well, just because we got into illustration as opposed to fine art, because we are storytellers, obviously. And that is, you know, illustration is the storyteller form for the visual artist. So I do wonder why there aren't more of us, if, you know, apart from just the daunting task of trying to put 50,000 words in right in front of the other. So I feel like there's going to be more and more of us since comics have been embraced so much recently, and a lot of new different kinds of storytelling forms are being embraced.
Is it possible that it's like, I don't know, that the publishers just aren't, no, but your name is attached to it though. I would say just that they're not buying the manuscripts from you, or just maybe people aren't committing the time to sit down and write that. I'm excited to know that like Peter Brown has a middle grade coming out.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's cool.
He's got one that,
think it releases.
And of course, Lane just published.
Lane did, yeah. And Dan Yaccarino has a great one too. And it's great to see that. And I think that to be able to write in long form like that and be able to sort of tell a longer story, but then also to see your illustrations blended in makes it kind of a great hybrid in storytelling too. Because of
I suppose just, it probably more than anything, it probably is just a time constraint, honestly.
I'm sure it would be.
I have a 3-year-old now. I don't work as much as I used to, but I used to be that illustrator who was probably working an average of, 13 hours a day. And that was just to stay on top of my picture book commissions and whatever various and sundry things I was working on at the time. So, the idea maybe to actually try to sit down and knock out 1,000 words after having already worked a 13 or 14 hour day is a little daunting.
That's huge. Yeah. And to be able to shift gears like that too, into, I don't know, there's something about writing that I think, I don't know. I guess I maybe in general find it daunting holding a book, feeling the thickness of the book and thinking that like, my word, I have to commit all of those words to some sort of document. It just seems long. It seems hard.
Yeah. And of course the major misconception is that we just sit down and type merrily for
all right.
2 months and then type the end and send. And that's, and of course nobody, I don't know anybody who writes that way. The possibly apocryphal story is that C.S. Lewis, would just get to the end of his story and send it off without having doing any rewriting. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I've never met anybody else who writes that way.
No, it only brought to mind that Stephen King apparently is known for sort of when he sits down to write, he writes from beginning to end and without really necessarily knowing where the story is going to go, or without making, I don't know, some people I know write chapters out of order, or they frame things differently that way, or they work from an outline, but apparently that's the way that he always attacked it. But I think also from talking to people, you just learn that there's 100 different ways to approach it, and it's all really about the way that you storytell and knowing yourself a little bit better in the process.
And that's what I try to tell kids when I go to do school visits and the like, is that everybody does do it differently. I don't outline. I pretty much just write and make it up as I go, but then I have to rewrite in order to make it good and to get rid of that character and to smooth out this storyline. And other people might plan out everything meticulously, but those people are still rewriting. So I really feel like the only constant is that nobody gets it right the first time, which there's usually in any group of 100 kids that I'm talking to, there's at least one face that lights up when I tell them that. And maybe if I'm very lucky, I just gave that kid the keys to the kingdom, where she thought that she, really had to know exactly what she was doing ahead of time. And now she knew that the play that she was engaging in and which she was like writing stories is actually writing and not just playing at being a writer.
Do you develop picture books the same way that you find you develop middle grade, where you sort of are writing the story as you go and then you go back and edit and work on the story that way?
Yeah, that is more true. Although with picture books, there is, there's, I would say, more of a variety of how much actual rewriting I do. I still don't think I've ever written a picture book manuscript where I didn't go back and change something. But and some picture books that was a matter of changing things extensively and working and reworking. I published a book called Moon Day a year or two ago that I worked on that off and on for like 15 years. And the earliest version of that story bears very little resemblance to what actually got to print. And then I have other picture books that I have to admit I probably did just sit down and write right away. And I went back and got rid of an adverb and changed a few words around, and maybe smoothed some transitions. But otherwise, they did come out very close to finished. And, I have one that's going through the pipeline right now that came out that way. I barely rewrote it. And my editor didn't edit it either.
Whoa.
And he thought, this is fine. I think he asked me to change a word,
And oh, that's great.
I mean, it's, I don't know that it's good or it's bad. It's just, it is what it is. You got to do what the story requires. And I know some people don't care for me telling stories like that because they don't want to diminish the art of picture bookmaking by admitting that sometimes the book really does happen in an afternoon. So I always try to stress that, some other book might have taken me 15 years, but I, sometimes it really does just kind of come out of whole cloth immediately and requires very little rewriting.
I don't know. I sort of feel like you need to have that experience, whether it's writing books or I don't know, doing any sort of work at all. You sort of need that experience where one time it does sort of come easily. It just comes, it presents itself as a completed idea in your head, and there doesn't need to be much editing. Just to know that that is possible, as much as it still takes some time where you're, as you're saying with Moonday, where you're laboring over it for 15 years, or maybe there's some books that you labored over just as long and they just weren't an idea that could work. It wasn't something that could ever come to publishing. And to know that's okay, that there's no one way that it works every time. There's no formula or some secret thing that works every time.
Yeah, I definitely don't think for me that there's a formula. Although if I was going to have a book that just kind of came out and was almost perfect and the editor didn't want to touch it either, I'm really glad that happened after 20 years of trying to do this rather than immediately, or else I might be a little messed up by and haunted by the experience of that, first perfect time for the rest of my life and wonder why it wasn't like that anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Hey, so was the True Meaning of Smack Day, that was your sort of middle grade debut, correct?
That's right.
Was that something that you had carried around, being that we were talking about going as a storyteller from working on picture books to writing something longer form? Was that a story that you were sort of playing around with in your head for a while?
In my head and also, on the screen, I was really, that was the work that I was doing when I was procrastinating from my real work, which at the time was probably painting a lot of dragons and orcs with bloody axes and things like that for Dungeons and Dragons and Magic the Gathering cards and stuff like that, which is how I used to primarily pay my bills, in the late 90s and in the early 2000s. And so when I didn't really feel like painting, that spellcaster elf today, that what I was doing instead was working on this story that I was thinking about, starting pretty much in 2001. It was when I first started really working on it. It was actually originally a picture book.
Okay.
It was originally a bad picture book. And it came out in picture book manuscript form, and I read it to my wife, and my wife is a very encouraging person, but luckily she's also honest, and she just shook her head, and I said, okay, all right, never mind. And then some weeks later, I kind of smacked my forehead and realized, oh no, it's a middle grade, isn't it? And that was exciting because I'd already been trying to find my way into a middle grade story and had been writing a lot of different ideas, and none of them seemed to be, they were all stalling out, after 5 or 10,000 words. And so this is the one that just kept writing itself. And so it was fortunate and unfortunate at the same time for me that during this time, my wife had to go off on these extended jaunts into the field to do her PhD work. So she would be gone for 2 months at a time. And so I would spend a good deal of the day working on this middle grade novel that nobody, including my agent, knew that I was working on. And then I would sort of panic at maybe 8 o'clock at night when I realized I hadn't done any real work that day. And I would work until 3 in the morning and go to bed and wake up the next day and do it all over again. And I think that's how I actually found the time personally to get a good start on this massive project for which no one was paying me and in which no one had any interest because they hadn't been told about it. After I had maybe 15 or 30,000 words, that was the point where I said to my agent, who must have been kind of a new agent for me at the time, I started working with Steve.
Yeah, Steve Malk.
At, and I want to say in maybe 2002 or something like that is when he first called me, having seen my work on the book The Dirty Cowboy, which is written by one of his clients. And so he thought he was just taking on an illustrator, and I told him I had some aspirations to write. So, you know, he knew that I might be a picture book writer as well, but I think I surprised him when I gave him, you know, these 20,000 words or whatever it was. And he decided he could sell it based on that. So he did. Then I had somebody paying me to write the rest of it.
Did you have, you said you did have picture books out at that point, or at least you had done illustration for?
Yeah. So let's see, I started working on my first picture book in 2001. That was The Dirty Cowboy, and that came out in 2003.
Okay.
And then I did another one for Farrar, Straus, and Giroux for Jill Esbaum called Steamboat A-Comin'. Which I don't think, you probably don't know it.
No, I haven't heard The Dirty Cowboy either. I'll have to look at that. Steamboat A-Comin'.
Yeah, The Dirty Cowboy's had a bit more of a life and has gotten, you know, a little bit of press just because it is probably my most challenged book.
Okay.
But it was the subject of a Dover, Pennsylvania school board challenge a couple of years back that, you know, got the attention of the ACLU and everything. So, and then that Streisand effect kicked in where, of course, everybody in that area started buying the book they weren't supposed to look at. But then, you know, after a couple of books with this editor I was working with at FSG, you know, I came to understand that this guy might eventually publish one of the manuscripts that I was writing, but he was not the right person for me. He and I just didn't have the same sensibility. I remember one story that he was interested in that he returned to me after having given me sort of a preliminary edit, and he had crossed out all the funny parts. So I thought, okay, this, you know, this guy he's a good picture book editor, but he's not going to be my picture book editor. Okay. So I was lucky enough to find Tamsin Weston at Harcourt at that point, and she bought a book of mine called Tree Ring Circus, and in short order also bought Frankenstein Makes a Sandwich, and and that's where those books came out. Let me see, in 2006, I believe. So that was my first foray into actually writing as well.
Nice. That was, I mentioned to you off recording that my first introduction to you, and then it was one of those things where I was seeing you everywhere, like when you buy a new car and then like everyone suddenly has your car.
Right.
My first introduction was through Pst, which I said is one of my favorite picture books, especially for the illustration. I love the way that the background is there and almost looks like a rough sketch compared to these beautifully painted main characters. And then just the payoff at the end that the girl is gathering all these different odd things for the animals at the zoo, and the payoff is great. And the typography was something that was really fun to look at too. So just all around to see the art in that, and then to realize that you were, this is, I think, when I was first starting in the library, maybe like 10 years ago, but to realize that you were sort of all over our library, and you continue to pop up in amazing ways was just, it was a wonderful treat to have that. And especially to see all the stuff you've done with Mac Barnett, with the Brixton brothers, and then to go into the books with Smek Day, and just everything. It's been really great to see you around, because you have a quality to you, Adam, where you just deliver. And it's something that I think I, as an adult, look forward to, as a librarian, I look forward to, because it means that I can deliver this to children too, and know, that they know what they're getting with you, and that it's something wonderful and will cause them to look new ways at the illustration on the page. And, it will be something that will engage them. And I love that about you.
I really hope that's true. And I hope that people look at my work and at least understand, whether they like it or not, that I'm never phoning it in the sense that I rarely repeated myself. I really feel like I try to come up with a new way of working that best suits the book every time. Sometimes probably to my detriment, you know, when I would really be firing on all cylinders at all times if I just oil painted every book that came along, because I think that's probably what I'm best at. But instead I do try to come up with new ways to express each book. And I've been lucky that I've had editors that have not told me, no, that you're the realistic but also cartoony oil painting guy. And that's what I hired you for, and that's what you ought to be doing right now. Pst is a good example of that. I always worry that that the name of that book is just going to sound like static or interference or something. So that's PSSST exclamation point. It's a book about a kid who goes to the zoo and all the animals keep on saying, "Hey, kid, pst, come here," and asking favors of her. And so that book has kind of three levels to it. It has the backgrounds, which, as you say, are kind of flat colors with colored line work. And then the main character and the character she interacts with are fully painted in oils. And then it has a collage element as well, as there are a lot of objects in the book that are actually collaged photographs that I took. And there was a reason for that, and that all the different items that the animals were asking for. The gorilla wants tires because his tire swing broke. The penguins want paint because their enclosure is all white and they think it's boring. And the sloths want bicycle helmets because they keep falling out of the tree. And the big reveal in that book, and I might as well reveal it because I don't think people can buy this book anymore anywhere. I think it's out of print, is that the animals are actually building a hot rod out of all these items. And I wanted kids to be able to tell, since the hot rod was also a collage of various photographs that I had taken, that, this thing is made up of all of those other things. I didn't want to have to explain to them that the animals built a hot rod out of all of these parts. I just wanted them to know it intuitively away. So that's what made sense in that book. And I learned on that book that if you walk around places like Target and Lowe's and Home Depot, and you take pictures of bicycle helmets and tires and things, you get thrown out of the store.
Do you really?
Yeah, apparently. I don't know what they thought I was doing. I got thrown out of three stores working on this. It was always like I would be photographing those bicycle helmets, and then like the biggest guy who was working at Target that night would come over and say, "Sir, you can't take pictures of bicycle helmets in Target." And I was like, "Why? Why can't you take pictures of bicycle helmets in Target?" And he didn't know. He was just, again, the largest guy that was working there that night. So he was the one that was sent over. So luckily, you know, he didn't make me erase my camera or anything, but he would kick me out, and then I'd go to the next store.
Go to the next one, yeah.
In the next store. I guess they thought I was some kind of lousy spy or something. Like Target's competitors really had no other way to gather intelligence about what Target was charging for bicycle helmets than to send a guy with a big conspicuous camera in to take pictures of them. But eventually I got all the photos I needed, and you know, then I arranged them together in Photoshop on my computer. But that was kind of how and why that book came together the way it did.
Well, and the way that you then approach that, to know the way that you're composing all of those illustrations in that collage together, to have it read that way, I think does read really well in the illustration, because you're seeing all of these items, as you said, look like they're just sort of fashioned together in sort of a Frankenstein type way. It reminds me of in the movie of, what was the sequel to The Wizard of Oz? The Return to Oz, and they make that couch where they kind of pull everything together.
Yeah.
And it's very apparent that these are all different items together. That works well. But then likewise, when you, with your illustration in Chloe and the Lion, I felt like that worked so well for that same way, that the way that picture books are a drama, they are a performance, and we're seeing, you know, you two creators in the story performing it. And so to set it on a stage and to have the art be photographs that you've posed, and to feel the depth in that work, was something that read really well through the illustration too. And that was one that I know we weren't the only ones to do it, but that was a book that we put on our mock Caldecott list when all of our fifth graders were reading these different books in the library, because the illustration was different and it was such a significant part of the storytelling.
I was really pleased, you know, I was not pleased, of course, not to win a Caldecott, but you know, I'm not going to say I don't put the phone by my bed the night before, but I never expect to win anything. But that was the year that I got a bunch of texts and emails and phone calls from people like apologizing to me that I didn't win the Caldecott. That was interesting. Like,
what a loving community we're in, that everyone feels bad when they feel like the person they were rooting for doesn't win.
Yeah, it just told me that was the book that really must have come closer than any, because that's never happened on any other book. I haven't gotten a bunch of condolences, you know, because Moon Day didn't win it or because Frankenstein Makes the Sandwich didn't win it. But when Chloe and the Lion got nothing, there seemed to be a bunch of people who had just taken it for granted that that was going to get an honor or something. So that was really cool. And that book, as you said, it really has kind of a let's put on a play kind of an atmosphere to it. And it has these different layers of reality where, you know, there are the actual author and illustrator ostensibly just talking directly to you in the book and to each other. And there is the story that they are creating. So I thought, you know, I had been looking for an excuse to really get into 3D art with some book. And this was the most obvious one where I needed to have Mac and me in the book be made very differently and be, you know, in a completely separate dimension from the characters of Chloe and the Lion and all these characters that I was ostensibly illustrating. So Mac and I were puppets, you know, made out of Sculpey clay and repurposed doll clothes that I'm no seamstress, but I had to like rip up doll clothes and sew them back together to fit the weird shaped bodies that I had made. And kids love this part. The shirt that the puppet version of me is wearing is actually made out of toilet paper.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Which turned out to be perfect and surprisingly durable. It's still holding together years later. There's trouble when you decide to make little clothes out of regular materials that you realize, well, you know, that this thick cloth scaled down to this small size is now not hanging and draping the way that a real shirt would, because, you know, there's just like a completely a different dynamic of the strength of the material and the way that the gravity is pulling on it. You know, a scaled down doll shirt just does not look like a regular shirt, but that toilet paper shirt really kind of looks like a regular shirt. It just looks like one of the white dress shirts that I have. So that was great. And then the drawings in that book are actually just drawings that I sort of superimposed over the weird little wooden set that I had made. This last weekend, I agreed to donate that set to the Mazza Museum in Findlay, Ohio.
Oh, that's great.
So it's going to have a nice home now where, you know, when they have it on display, I guess they'll have it on a little pedestal or something, and you'll be able to see this, you know, I was way out of my depth on this one. I'm not a woodworker. I don't sew. I'm not even a photographer. So, you know, most of this book was made out of disciplines that I had no business doing, but, thanks to the magic of Photoshop, I think I was able to sort of fix all my mistakes and make it look halfway competent.
I think it looks beautiful. And I was actually, I'm glad to hear that the set, as it were, was donated to the museum. I was talking to Steve Light, who has also done different pieces of art that way, and to hear art brought into the Eric Carle Museum or to Mazza is great to know that there are physical locations where the art can live on, but also that people can experience it, because we don't often get to experience the art beyond the picture book, which is, you know, in some cases experience enough, but to be able to see in real life that art, and sometimes even just the dimensions, the texture of it, all those different qualities that went into it, is really a special thing.
Now, more than any other book I've worked on, that Chloe and the Lion has got to be the book where people are looking at it and saying, "What is this?" Yeah. Like, I don't understand, you know, how this book was made. So yeah, that set that I made is not doing me or anybody else any good, just sitting on a shelf in my studio. So I'm glad that I visited Mazza recently, and they shyly asked if I might consider donating something, and I just realized that was the perfect thing.
Did you like turn to them Indiana Jones style and yell, "It belongs in a museum"?
I don't know if it belongs in a museum or not. That's a little self-congratulatory.
But well,
if they want it, I'm happy to get it out of my insular little studio.
Hey, so let me bring us back to J-Lo and Boov and all of the wonderful world of the true meaning of Smack Day. Because I'd like to talk about, well, let me talk first about that being adapted into a film, because that was a huge deal. And then I want to make sure we get a chance to end with Smack for President, which is such a wonderful book. So can I just ask you, I mean, to debut a middle grade novel and then at whatever point to have it actually fully realized as a film adaptation? I know that rights can be sold and there's a lot of things that can happen, but ultimately to make a movie is it doesn't often get to the point where things actually come out.
Right. And I think this is the sort of experience I was alluding to earlier that might ruin me for the rest of my life, because here's this thing that actually worked. And I'm, you know, I'm sort of dipping my toe into some other projects movie wise. And those are probably never going to get made. And for the rest of my life, I'm going to wonder, you know, why this screenplay I wrote or that book that I sold the option to doesn't go to screen, as though there's something wrong with any of them. When, of course, you know, just... I don't know. I can't even imagine how many books. I would love to hear the number. How many children's books are just optioned every year and go nowhere? Visiting DreamWorks over the years, as I have, I've seen so many things up on their walls that then just they just disappeared. You know, at some point they lost faith in them, or you know, it seemed just a little bit too experimental, and so I've seen a lot of great stuff that was merely in the, you know, concept art form, or maybe was just a post-it note on director Tim Johnson's wall or something. But, you know, now I'm disappointed to know that those things are never actually going to come to fruition.
Yeah, and to have not only it be adapted and to have that, but I remember seeing on Facebook or Twitter you sharing just sort of all the advertisement, all the marketing that came behind it too, to see your character. I mean, it's unreal to see... to see J-Lo on airplanes and on whatever it was, like there was like some food, maybe it was like hot dog buns or something random like that. But just
were chicken nuggets, they were Boov-shaped chicken nuggets, and they were Boov-shaped, I guess you'd call them macaroni and cheese shapes, which I think were like, those are a real Rorschach test. I don't think the average person would have, they looked like a Duchamp painting, you know, like nude descending a staircase. They were just these weird cubist nightmares that if you held them just right and somebody nudged you, you'd go, oh, okay, I get it. That's Captain Smack. But there was always a little bit of a remove with these things because, of course, they did change my character, J-Lo, into O, and they made their own version of the Boov, which still had a lot of DNA and similar with my aliens, but they were their own thing. So, you know, it was very weird to see the character on the side of an airplane. But then again, you know, in my head, it was always, well, that's their character.
Yeah. Okay.
Not my character. Even their version of Gratuity, of Tip, who, you know, stayed very similar to how I had her in the book. Nonetheless, she was still their girl. And so it was all weird, but... you know, it wasn't like somebody had just excavated my thoughts and stuck them up on the side of a, you know, on a billboard or an airplane or
You were able to sort of remove yourself a little bit more. But you're also in this unique case too, where a lot of these middle grade novels that get adapted into film, they're not illustrated the way that, I mean, you actually have. Being that you're the creator of these stories, you actually did have an idea in mind of what it would look like and what it would, of the way the characters would interact. And so there, I don't know, in that way, there is a little bit more of the, oh, I can actually see that they're changing the way that they want this character to appear versus something like, oh, I read the book and that's not at all the way I pictured the character. When we read True Meaning of Smack Day, we don't need to worry about how you're trying to portray the character, how we would picture them, because we can see it. It reads right on the page.
Yeah, and that always makes me wonder in that sort of college dorm room conversation, do we all think of the same things when we think of the same thing? What does green look like to you?
Oh, there you go.
And,
yeah.
You know, like I always wonder with authors who don't illustrate, like, you know, how thoroughly are they seeing a scene in their mind? I have no idea. And of course, I'll never know, but it's always something that I wonder about because because I do think I am composing these things as I would illustrations, even if I don't illustrate them, and I'm sort of casting them and playing a movie in my mind. And I have a feeling that probably everybody does that. If there's, you know, if my training as an illustrator causes that to be any more real or than anybody else's experience, I don't know. But I was lucky I was really very lucky when it comes to the character design, and I came to understand that.
Go ahead. I was just gonna say, I think it actually turned out wonderful. I think that it's great to have the book and to have the movie and to have two separate things that are great that we can enjoy together and know that they're two separate things.
Well, at one point on Facebook recently, I actually posted some character designs that were wonderful character designs but did not get used in the movie. And also their version of the alien looked nothing like my version of the alien. And I think it was my second visit to DreamWorks where they were ready to sort of debut, this is what the Boov are going to look like, and mm-hmm. this is what Tip is going to look like. And, you know, Tim Johnson showed me what O was going to look like. I think at the time his name was still J-Lo. And my, you know, I got to admit, I probably got a little quiet. I was like, oh, yeah, they changed it. It's their thing now. You know, that doesn't look anything like my aliens. And yet they had all these great ideas for them. And I think during the course of the day, I sort of warmed to their designs a bit. And then Tim said, oh, you'll be interested in this as an illustrator. Here's some other designs that we came up with, including a bunch of designs that, you know, the mandate that week was, hey, forget about Adam Rex's stuff. Just design whatever you think would be the coolest alien. And so they showed me all this stuff that just bore no resemblance at all to my version of the Boov. And one of those designs I found online and posted to Twitter or Facebook or maybe both. And that was when I looked at it and went, wow, okay, yeah, look at, you know, I turned back to their actual design. There he is. There's my guy.
Oh.
Okay, sure. He's still garbage can shaped. He's still 3 feet tall. He's still got a whole bunch of legs. You know, who cares if he has six legs instead of eight now? Who cares if his eyes are bigger? You know, what difference does it make if they change the color? You know,
they maintain the spirit.
Yeah, they maintain the spirit, absolutely. And I've been saying in a very flippant way lately that watching your book get turned into a movie is kind of like that scene in The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, speaking of which, in which the Tin Man systematically has all of his body parts chopped off and replaced with tin, but in a good way, somehow. like maybe in this example, the heart stays intact. And I think that's what happened, that they kind of replaced everything, but the heart was still there.
Yeah.
And so that was the most important thing for me, even if they had to end up changing the plot and revising the characters a bit.
And then at the beginning of this year, you followed up the book with the sequel with Smick for President, which it's one of those wonderful things where the sequel is like every bit as good as the first novel. It just feels like you wrote a 700 page book. And when we got the True Meaning of Smick Day, we only got the first half of that book.
That would be a nice idea for the future. I think a lot more people are reading the True Meaning of Smick Day than Smick for President. So I would love if eventually they just decided to package them into the complete Smack or something like that. You know, the way that like Douglas Adams is, five-part
The Hitchhiker's Guide is all together. Yeah.
Yeah. They'll just put that in a big volume. And I would love to do that someday just so more people get the entire story. I loved coming back to these characters and found that with very, very little effort, I just sort of got back into their heads right away, even though years had passed. I have to admit that I never, you know, when people would ask me, are you going to write another one? I thought, I don't know. True Meaning of Smack Day is pretty self-contained. It tells a full story. I'm not sure there's another story to tell. And this is going to sound a little mercenary, but then after I realized that the movie was greenlit, I thought I should come up with another story to tell. And I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it just to do it, you know, but then, you know, I think I was starting to think about it during an election year. So I, you know, something came to me and I realized, no, this would actually be a lot of fun, and I'd be able to address some things that I couldn't address in The True Meaning of Smek Day. Let me see if I do have this book in me.
I was going to ask, mind just giving like a summary of the sequel of Smek for President? I am now thinking of those people that haven't read it yet, because it's been out since, was it February that it came out?
Yeah, February or March. I don't remember.
It was in time for us to have it in our libraries. I remember that, because I remember being able to hand it off to children. February.
Yeah, because the movie came out in March, so they wanted to make sure it was out there with enough time that people would, that it would benefit from the big ramped up DreamWorks marketing machine. But it is very much a sequel to my book and not to the movie. So anybody who has seen the movie will know that there was an alien invasion, and the aliens sort of decide that we would all be happier on a reservation that they set up for us so that they can have the rest of the planet to themselves. And my main character, Gratuity, goes on a big road trip to try to find her mom and is joined by a fugitive alien named J-Lo. And in my book, as in the movie, J-Lo is responsible for accidentally alerting the Boov's mortal enemies, the Gorg, to their new home on Earth. And they mess with that a little bit in the movie, but I won't get into too many of the differences. It's just J-Lo is at fault for that, and he's blamed for it. And J-Lo, in the end, helps save the world with the Gratuity's help. Yeah. But his people, the Boov, in my book, they never know that. They never realize that this great bungler who ruined everything for the Boov was actually the one who got rid of the Gorg in the end, after all. So in Smek for President, J-Lo decides that what he really needs to do is travel to the new Boov homeworld, which is on Saturn's moons, and plead his case to Captain Smek, the leader of all the Boov, and explain what happened, and then maybe he would be able to be accepted back by his people. But Captain Smek, as it turns out, is sort of embattled. He, for the first time, his position as the high leader of all the Boov for life is being questioned, and they're calling for elections because they, they blame him for what happened during the Earth invasion and the Gorg invasion as well. So Smek realizes there's he's not going to gain any political capital by telling the truth about J-Lo. So instead, he captures J-Lo and refuses to let him speak to the world, and he tries to gain points in the polls by being the man who caught this great enemy of the Boov. So Gratuity and J-Lo, they need to escape, and they need to tell the truth and bring down Captain Smek. And I think that's a general, if not meandering, description of... I've never been very good at the elevator pitch. It never even occurs to me to come up with one until suddenly somebody's asking me in 50 words or less to explain what the book is about, and I realize I don't know. But,
well, I think you summarized it really well, and I think to say that it's just really the second half of the story also captures it. Your voice, your humor is so apparent there, and I love J-Lo's voice. I just love doing impersonations of J-Lo is like the greatest. But I think you have a great story there, and it's fun to be able to leave Earth and to head to Titan, to New Boov World, and to experience that story elsewhere. And I don't know, I think that to be able to, just the talent you have to be able to write something that reads aloud so well, but also is over multiple readings still so funny and so effective at being a page turner in that way, I think is a testament to your storytelling. I assume it's also going through a lot of edits and really trying to, I don't know, let some sort of great inner moral writing compass guide you to know when you're moving things along fast enough or not. But yeah, it's great though.
I honestly think that one, I had to write that one so much faster than I did The True Meaning of Smek Day. And in a weird way, I feel like it benefited from it, that I didn't second guess as much. And Not to say that I didn't really need to heavily edit The True Meaning of Smek Day, but that was my first novel. And I do think I've learned some things since then, and I have a little more intuitive idea of how to shape a story. But it, yeah, I'm really pleased with the way it came out. And now, of course, everybody is asking me, are you going to write a third one? And I'm going back to the same, I don't know. I feel like I've told a complete story now, and I really don't think that it has another sequel. But, you know, maybe there's the Gork Strike Back or something along those lines. It'll have to come to me. I'm too busy with other things to be thinking about it. But if something does just sort of knock me over and demand to be written, then perhaps I'll go back to those characters again.
You almost hinted at it that this could be your chance to do your nod to Douglas Adams and make it book 3 of 2.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. The 3-part duology.
Exactly.
Of the Smek Smeres.
Adam, do you have Smek Smeres? Oh, I like that.
Yeah, that's the official name now. They were just going to call it the Smek series, and I asked if it was at all possible or if the marketing department was going to kill me if I required that it be called the Smek Smeres, and props to Disney Hyperion that they went for it.
All right. Smek Smeres it is. Adam, do you have other stuff? Like, what's coming out next for you? You were talking about working on a picture book. Is that what's next up releasing this year, or I guess maybe even 2016?
You know, I don't know what my release schedule is. I wrote a book that I am not illustrating. It's a picture book that'll be illustrated by Christian Robinson.
And whoa, indeed, nice.
Yeah, I was so lucky to get him. And indeed, he's already finished it, but I don't know when it's going to come out because it is a beginning of school book. So there's no way it's going to be ready by the end of this summer. So I think maybe there might be a whole year still before that comes out. I've written another picture book that I will not be illustrating. That's in the pipeline too. And I'm currently illustrating another one with Mac Barnett that is sort of speaking of spiritual sequels, it's kind of a spiritual sequel to Chloe and the Lion, if not actually a straight sequel. And I got a couple other picture books that I've signed up as well, and trying to figure out what my next novel is on top of that. So,
well, great to see you revisiting some stuff as well as getting to work with some new people. And I love this notion too, as an artist that you are having the opportunity for other people to illustrate your work. I think that's a really neat thing. I mean, I think we saw, even with, you brought up Christian Robinson, that the Last Stop on Market Street was that opportunity for him to work with Matt De La Pena in that same capacity. And I think beautiful things can come out that way too.
Yeah. And I think Christian is the perfect person for me to work with, and that he's one of my heroes, one of my just illustration idols. And B, I don't think anybody would ever mistake his work for mine. And indeed, if I had tried to illustrate this book myself, and I don't think I would have done a very good job, I probably would have tried to rip off Christian Robinson anyway. So I might as well get the actual guy to do it. But I, for some time now, I've been wanting to have the experience of being the author who waits to see what an illustrator is doing with his work. And this was, again, it was just the perfect book, and that I really do love this manuscript. This is the one actually that came out almost perfect and didn't really get edited. And I don't know how I would have illustrated it. I have no idea. Like you'll see when it comes out, and maybe you'll know what I mean. There's, you know, there's this very weird visual riddle that had to be solved with this book, and I didn't have a clue how to do it. And Christian just knocked it out of the park. So I couldn't be happier.
I can't wait for it then.
People who follow Christian on Instagram they've actually seen some stuff from this book in progress. So it's actually why I joined Instagram myself, just so I could see Christian work.
We'll have to look that way. Well, I guess in that same vein of people that you admire, people that you want to keep around, let me close with this question that's a tradition around the podcast, and that's, I'm assembling an all-star Kidlit Dream Team kickball tournament, and Adam, I'd love to know what one person, alive or past, from the Kidlit world you would want on your team, and why.
Huh, yeah. Yeah, I don't feel like, I don't know what honestly what other kind of answers you've gotten to this one, but I don't think Kidlet as a whole is probably the best place from which to draw kickball players or the players of any physical team sport at all.
That might be true.
You know, and I might be selling some people short. I think Šeško would be really good at kickball, but I think it's because he would cheat. He would just... I think he would have the stones to just grab the kickball when it comes to him and, like, run to first base with it and then throw it over the guy's head and keep going. And what are you going to do, tell Šeško no? But I think, like, you know, Carson Ellis would probably just spend the whole game decorating the dugout with... portraits of Russian aristocracy, or, you know, Greg Pozzoli would be making everybody team t-shirts with funny elephants on them or whatever. But nonetheless, I still think that I would be the chief liability on any kickball team just based on past performance and in public school. So I think my answer to your question would be Lewis Carroll.
All right.
Because Lewis Carroll. And I might be selling him short, but, based on pictures we've all seen of Lewis Carroll, I think he would be distractingly bad at kickball. And that's what I would need. I would need somebody who would draw attention away from me.
All right.
Because I don't know when was the last time I played kickball, but the last time I remember playing kickball was in middle school. And it was a rainy day, so we were playing indoor kickball in the gymnasium, and I was carving out my usual position as being just the worst. And then I remember this kid, Gil, came up to the plate, and I was not really in any position to look down on anyone, but I still think that based on where I was standing, I could at least maybe see the top of Gil's head. I was just a little above him in my mind in the hierarchy of middle school. And he stepped up to the plate, and some guy shouted out, "Oh, great, another Adam Rex." And I was like, no, I'm another Gil. Like, I'm not the standard of bad kickball playing. I can't be the yardstick, you know? That kid's the yardstick. So I wouldn't want to be the yardstick in this case either, so... if anybody had to be shouting anything, I would hope I would come to the plate and they would say, "Oh, great, another Carroll."
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you, and you're rest assured you're not another yardstick in children's literature. If nothing else, that's good. Like what you hear? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Leave a comment on the blog at lgbpodcast.blogspot.com or rate Let's Get Busy on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's Koko Sleep, and I'll see you there.